ears, and there's other things in the sunspots that Kara like. So, they're trying to find, look for explanations, and the major, the dominant, in the 20th century, of course, the dominant one has been the group one. Something within the market, something within capitalism causes this. Causes an inflationary period where there's money supply increases, prices increase, increased productive activity, everybody's happy, and all of a sudden, bingo, there's a collapse, there's bankruptcies, unemployment, prices fall. And this is a terrible thing, and the government just step in and iron it out, which is sort of the usual conclusion. So one of the indictments of free market capitalism is it causes business cycles, causes inflation, unemployment, and all the rest of it. And most, I would say most economists today still hold this one form or another. The Keynesian variant, which we might go into, is that there's under, what happens is the market economy doesn't spend enough. And because of that, and recessions, and therefore, it spends too much in inflations, and therefore, you have to have something outside of the system which can correct this. Of course, that's good old Popov government. So like the god out of the machine, which comes in and corrects everything. If people spend too much, absorb, as the great Keynesian phrase, which I love particularly, sop up excess purchasing power. So like the bounty of better pick-up. So, and if they don't spend enough, you pump spending in order to get the juices going. So that's The government, as I say, steps in as the corrector of laws. The Keynesian theory, by the way, Keynes had no theory of the business cycle. He didn't say why there's underspending, overspending. He said, at one point, he said, investment increases because of animal spirits. And then it decreases because animal spirits, I guess, collapse. So at any rate, so there's no theory of the business cycle. Somebody said, we don't know what caused the business cycle. We do know, however, it's caused by inflation is caused by overspending, depression is caused by underspending, therefore the government says, you know, this job of the government is to pump spending in and sop it up. And so the metaphor I like to use to explain the Keynesian doctrine is that the government is sort of like the wheel of a car. The economy is the car. The economy is going around this tightrope or this ledge, very narrow ledge. On one side is the abyss of depression, the other side is the other abyss of the quagmire, the mountain cliff, or whatever, inflation. And even though the Keynesians, at least non-leftist Keynesians, moderate Keynesians will admit, the free market works very well in the microsphere, the sphere I've been talking about before, the supply and demand intersecting and clearing the market and all that. That's great. They said free market's good micro, but macro is total chaos. There's no equilibrating process in the macrosphere. There's nothing which will keep the economy in an even keel. And therefore, we need the government to adjust it, to come in and fix everything up. As a matter of fact, I'll go into that because this is every macro textbook has inflicted this upon you, so I think we'll go into this. There's millions of words that were written about it, lots of equations, but the essence of it is very simple. You find the essence of all this stuff, and you penetrate to the core, it's quite simple. One thing is when Keynes' general theory came out, I went to college, it was about 6 years after Keynes' general theory came out. Nobody understood what the hell he was saying. Because it seemed very peculiar. On one page he said that the key to my thought is that savings always equals investment. Always equals investment. Key. 2 pages later he said the key to my thought is savings always differs from investment. How do you grapple with this? So, since Keynes had already established a reputation as a big shot, as a distinguished intellectual and economist, therefore, he couldn't be wrong, couldn't be absurd or whatever. There must be something deep in the new jargon he created, all sorts of new phrases, marginal capacity to consume, multiply, all that. And the older economists said the guy's full of prunes and forgot it. The younger economists who were emerging in graduate school, young professors, said, aha, this is it. And they started figuring out what the master meant. Sure of heart that the master was right. If you read the introduction of Samuelson's most famous Keynesian, I guess, around now, I think it was his Foundations of Economic Analysis, I believe, or also his first edition of the economics textbook. He said what a great joy it was, what a wonderful thing to be under 35 when Keynes' general theory came out, because he was young enough to appreciate this great revelation, this great truth which is emerging upon the world. So it took about, I would say about 10, 15 years before Keynes figured out what he was saying, to try to rationalize this and make it consistent. As soon as they did that, the whole Keynesian theory began to collapse around the edges. As soon as it was fairly clear to them what he said. They're still arguing about what Keynes really meant. There are conservatives who think Keynes didn't really mean what the Keynesians said he meant. I personally think he didn't mean it, if he meant anything at all. I mean, the Keynesians were the only person to make people make any sense whatsoever out of this mishmash, this total muck. Okay. All right, there are no Keynesian diagrams in the general theory. You won't find a diagram in it, it's all verbiage, incoherent verbiage. An interesting thing is Keynes was a good writer. I mean, qua writer, he's very, very good, but when you get to the general theory, I think the incoherence of the thought was kind of profound. It's almost the incoherence in the language.
How old was he when he wrote?
Well, he was fairly elderly at that point. He died about 1945, I think, so he was older than 36. I guess he was 50s, 60s, something like that. 60s. Something like that. At any rate, the thing is Keynesian cross. Instead of having price on the y-axis and quantity on the x-axis, something different happens now. You've got dollars on both axes, each one being national income or whatever.
That's also national product.
Spending, yeah, it's the same stuff. It's just slight variation. Yeah.
Is that
the
gross national product?
Eh?
Gross national product. Is that Keynes' idea?
Yeah. More or less, well, the statisticians discovered a little bit before that, but Keynes needed the concepts in order to develop the theory. You can believe in the gross national product without being a Keynesian, but you can't be a Keynesian without believing in the gross national product, let's put it that way. The national income and the whole approach. So, the axes are the same. Key thing, billions of dollars or whatever, billions of francs or whatever. The axes are identical. So this is 100, that's 100, the same distance. So since the axes are identical, you then have a 45-degree angle, which is also identical. So this is 100, 100. So the coordinates are 100, 100, 200, 200, or whatever, going on up. So this 45-degree line then becomes national income, or gross national product, or whatever, you know, variant. It doesn't make any difference. Let's say national income, let's say people receive, how much will people spend? Okay, this person gets $10,000 a year, they spend maybe less, maybe more, somewhere fluctuating around there. There's no particular law you can think of to equilibrate spending and income, something saying, well, you know, they spend less, they'll save it, they spend more, they're going to debt or whatever. Keynes is trying to get a theory of a macro optimum here, macro equilibrium, so to speak. His theory was that expenditures out of income, okay, will have a certain function. Expenditures have a certain function of income. And it's a function shaped like so. It's flatter, the expenditure function is flatter than the national income function, which is called Y for some unknown reason. They couldn't call it I because I had already taken it for investment, symbol for investment. So they made it Y. So now this is not self-evident, to say the very least. I mean, if you're looking, if you think of expenditure function, if, for example, people received last year $500 billion, they'll probably spend around $500 million, maybe less, maybe more. Let's say less. But whatever, there's no reason to assume that we'll be spending much more than income as you keep going to the left at some point, and much less than income as you keep going to the right at some point. It's much more likely to be something like some zone around here, right? There's no reason, if you look at it sort of rationally, there's no reason to think there's any kind of point there. And how Keynes got to the point, we'll see as we develop this. So then you have this income expenditure. Then he said, well, If income is higher than this point, let's say it's, I don't know, $300 billion. If income is higher than this, people spend less, and the as you keep going, as income keeps going up, you spend less and less. What happens to the money, by the way? As Rand would say, blank out. The money, in a Keynesian phrase, leaks out of the economy, so it disappears. One Keynesian used the term bathtub. It's like a leaky bathtub. It's got money pouring in, and a whole bunch of money leaks out. Therefore, it's not around. Therefore, it's not around the fuel economy. Right? It leaks. All right. So this leakage that Keynes calls saving. Saving is the thing that leaks out. Now, the only possible sense you can make out of that is to say people just pile the money out, hoard it. The old-fashioned concept of hoarding. They just have it there. They have the dollar bills or the gold coins. They just keep it there, under the floorboards. But as it's supposed to happen more to keep going. So you have this concept of the leakage. Right? And then you have, if the economy is down here, if you have, let's say, $100 billion national income, people spend $200 billion. Where do they get the money from? How do you have a situation? Consider yourself. People are receiving in payment $100 billion. They spend $200 billion. Where the hell do they get the money? Okay? Supposedly from under the floorboards, some from heaven. Again, as I say, blank out. All right? So, all right. the only sense made out of the Keynesians who worked out these diagrams, the only thing they had was this. They said, well, Keynes was thinking about two different things. He was looking at a time dimension, and he said as follows. Let's say national income is $500 billion here. So, if you look at it as a time dimension, day one, year one, whatever you want to call it, some time period, say year one, income is $500 billion. It's this expenditure is $400 million. The rest of it leaks out. The rest of it's piled up in hoards. It's under the floorboards or whatever. So that means that since expenditure equals income, okay, this is the other part of the thing. How can it be different? How can it be the same? Right, it's the same as follows. All right, here's the way to build that up. I spend 30 cents for a newspaper. I talk about how both parties benefit. If you don't concentrate on the newspaper, let's talk about the money. Okay? Here's me. I spend my expenditure, small e, is equal to 30 cents. And then news dealer's income, in a gross sense of money coming into his pocket, is 30 cents. Small y. Okay? So expenditure, every time anybody spends any money, my expenditure is, by definition, equal to his income and determines it. Expenditure of the money is the active force. We're looking at the money. So I spend the 30 cents, he gets it. My 30 cents I spend is exactly equal to his 30 cents that he gets it, except he drops it down the grade of the railing or something. It's rare. So therefore, expenditure is identical with income and also determines income. Expenditure is the active force if you're looking at money income. Okay, so, okay, fine. Then what they do is they aggregate for the whole economic system. Every person in the economy spends money over a certain time period, a year. So this is called capital E, which is the sum of all the small E's. And capital Y is the sum of all the small Y's. And therefore, capital E has got to be identical to capital Y. It's got to determine it. All right. I mean, all this I think is true. I don't know what it gets you particularly. It might be interesting for some statistical purposes, right? So, the people spend during the year $500 billion. They have income. They spend $400 billion. What happens to the $400 billion? That becomes income. In other words, expenditure is the active force. You spend $400 billion. National income is $400 billion. What happens to the other $100 billion? Leaked away. Right? So, this means that year two, the next year, income is $400 billion. In other words, the only thing that makes sense out of Keynes saying on one page expenditure always equals income, on the next page expenditure always differs from income, let's look at it in a different time dimension. And what he was saying was, this year's expenditure determines next year's income, or this month's expenditure determines next month's income. Right? So you have a ratchet effect. Income is 500, 100 leaks away somewhere, so the next year, income is only 400. you're now down to 400. And then you have a free will decision by the masses. How much do you spend out of 400? You spend, when you look at it, it's a function of income. According to the postulate, it's not proven anymore, just postulated expenditures like this. This is now at 350. So you spend 350. Year three, income is 350. This is here. And you know, a couple of years or so, you get back to 300, which is equilibrium. At 300, whatever that is, year five or something, expenditure is 300, income is 300, and expenditure will again be 300. And there you are, your equilibrium national income. The thing is Keynesian macro equilibrium. So, if on the other hand you start from below that, you're here at 100 billion, 250 billion, let's say. The income is 150 billion. This is year one. This is, yeah, this is a 4-year one, really. Okay, so income, 150 billion. How much do people spend? They spend 250 billion. Where do they get the money from? They take it out of the leak, or whatever, out of the leaky bathtub. They take it out of the hoards, they take it out of the mattress. They spend 250 billion.
But if they can spend an extra 100 now, why can't they spend an extra 100 and expend 450 or 500 back in year two over there?
I mean, you're saying why is expenditure supposed to be a flat function of income? Good question. I don't know.
This is absolute garbage.
I'm trying to explain how he gets to this. Each step is garbage. I mean, the conclusion is garbage, each step is garbage.
And there's no need to try and understand him actually because it is garbage.
No, I think you should understand. We argue with these people all the time. We don't understand what their terms mean. We understand how they get to what the basis of the whole thing is. So, the next year, the next year two, then, income is equal to expenditure. In other words, look at a little algebra here. Expenditure sub n is equal to and determines y sub n plus y, okay? And then out of that, you make your free will decision how much to spend. So you're getting down, so this is now 250 up here. People spend 280. Expenditure is still higher than income, but less so. They take it more, some more out of the floorboards, out of leaking out of the pools, whatever it is. And et cetera, et cetera. And finally, year 4 or 5, you get to 300 again, where this is 300, that's 300, this is 300. There you are, equilibrium national income. Well, aside from the leakage part, which is obviously insane to begin with, I mean, people do not do this in practice. You don't have a statistic that shows an income, national income is 300 billion, people spend 500 billion next year. Okay, they ain't got the money. Aside from that, how could this thing ever change? So how did this change here? But supply and demand, you know how things change. The prices, the equilibrium price, it changes either the supply change or demand change. There's only one function, expenditure and income. How the hell do you ever get out of this? That's an interesting point. I don't think, if there is such a function, you can ever get out of it. National income should stay the same forever. All right, so...
where do you get it so you've got to be constant, though?
Huh?
I mean, where do you get it so you've got to be constant?
They have to prove a couple of things. They have to prove that it's stable function. It's function should be in some sense stable. Okay, you also have to prove it's flat, like that. Neither is self-evident, neither is true. Okay? I'm exploring more and more of this insanity as we keep on with this.
Sorry, I'm lost. Where does the 100 go? It's somewhere.
What,
does it ever reappear?
It leaks. Well, it could reappear over here if you're down here somehow.
No, they don't explain.
How
can
you just
explain?
It's gone.
It's put into mattresses now. We get distracted later on.
You're not supposed to ask that question.
You're trying to look at this rationally.
Just as long as I can be lost.
Right. From a mattress fire, you're just smoking.
Right.
Okay. So, if you could spend the extra 100 over there, why can't you spend it over here?
That's another question I'm supposed to ask.
Because it's a fixed function, it's a determined function in some way. Why is it a determined function? Well, we'll see why they think of it.
Well, if this on the right is true, then how do you ever get to the left?
Who knows? I don't see how you ever get out of here. You know, once you're there.
Well,
they have to assume a change in the function, which they do. I mean, it's a very, very peculiar, because you only have one function, one independent thing. It's not, Supply and demand have two things going on. Supply is demand. You can talk about intersection. There's only one thing going on. It's a very odd kind of concept.
And the other thing is that whilst it may well be true that because of reporting purposes and collection of data, that in fact you've got the time delay there, but nevertheless, at the moment that I spend a buck on something, the other person receives it. So there's no delay inherent in the transaction.
Well, it's called a Robertsonian day. D.H. Robertson, kind of an interesting guy. He was a Keynes hated him, but anyway, he had a concept of time period as abstract days, a day defined as we get income, you can't spend it until tomorrow. So he thought in terms of day, but if you take a day one, day two, it looks pretty ridiculous. So that was it's sort of an abstract thing where it obviously doesn't happen. In the real world, you're spending money, getting money all the time.
Most people spend it before they get
it. So for that reason alone, this thing is sort of shot. Anyway, you have to assume abstract time periods where everybody gets a lot of money and doesn't spend it until the next time period. So you can call this day one, day two, day three, if you want, month, week one, week two, week three. So
this is a serious theory.
It's very serious. It ran the whole world for 50 years. From the late 30s to the mid 70s.
I know, it did. I'm just amazed.
This is still a major, I would say most economists are now still Keynesian, even though Keynesianism is sort of pretty dead from the neck up. They're very confused. Or, it's still swinging to this.
Galbraith is an advisor, an economic advisor to our Prime Minister. This is garbage too, but it's like
Galbraith is also a Keynesian, top of everything else. He doesn't stress it.
Forbes magazine, I think it was, did an article a little while ago on Keynes and Schumpeter.
Schumpeter. Yeah, it was Peter Drucker. That. Yeah, it wasn't too good. I thought Drucker was pushing Schumpeter for the wrong reasons. So, yeah, it was an interesting article. I didn't buy it. So let's assume this is correct for a minute. Let's assume there is an equilibrium. We're stuck at the end of it. Who the hell really cares? What difference does it make? Okay? That's the second step in this mighty theory here, edifice. It makes a difference for the following reason, according to the Keynesians. Production is one-to-one correlation with national income. And employment is a one-to-one correlation with production. So that, ipso facto, QED or whatever, the higher the national income, the more the production, the higher production, the higher employment. The lower national income, the lower production, the lower employment. Severe unemployment problems, the lower national income. If you look at that, you look at this thing, it seems to be totally obvious, total garbage. National income has gone up for, tenfold in the last 100 years or something. Employment remains the same. There's no difference in employment. Why should employment have anything to do with national income? What's going on here? Even production is hardly have a one-to-one correlation with that. It's spending. So a couple of hidden assumptions here, which are a clinker. It took until 1950, a whole series of equations for Freckle Modigliani, distinguished Italian American Keynesian, to come out and figure out how Keynes gets to this thing where employment depends on national income, where the lower the national income, the more unemployment. And the hidden assumption there, the clinker in the arm, which is one of the beginnings of the retreat from Keynesianism among the high theorists. Okay? They looked at this thing and they finally understood the only equation how they all fit together. They come, my God. He's assuming rigid wage rates downward. Assumption is, which is Britain in those days was fairly accurate in a sense, that wage rates can only go up, they can't fall. Why can't they fall? All sorts of institutional reasons. Unions, government minimum wage laws, unemployment insurance, all these things keep wages from falling. Okay? Wage rates are fixed downward. Now he makes some sense out of some of this stuff. Namely, that if national income is $300 billion, as a big deflation, let's say. Let's say the money supply is, because Keynes doesn't talk about the money supply. Let's say money supply is cut in half, and prices and wages are cut in half, more or less. Everybody should be more or less in the same position. It shouldn't be any big problem, after a certain transition period. But if wage rates remain the same as they were when money and prices and everything else was doubled, then of course you have a real problem, because unemployment is a function of wage rates. So that, if the... If demand for labor, so to speak, is cut in half, and wage rates stay at the original level, then you do have a very heavy on plan. It's nothing to do with the free market. It's nothing to do with the alleged need of the free market for the steering wheel. It means because wage rates are rigid downward by exogenous union and government forces. So it's a very different... If Keynes had admitted that from the very beginning, it would have been a very different sort of story. It would mean that the onus of unemployment rests on government rather than on the free market. Okay, but it took a long, it took 15 years to realize this is a hidden assumption. And even then, they weren't very happy about this, the Keynes deal. So it's tucked under, you know, some kind of limbo there, corollary. Okay, so rigid wage rates downward become a key to this. The unemployment problem. Okay, so... And it became then pretty evident that the whole Keynesian trick was to solve depression by creating inflation, by creating increasing money supply, by increasing prices, so to trick unions and the workers into accepting lower real wage rates while the money wage rates remain the same. That the essence of a political Keynesianism. It's a whole bunch of trickery. It's duplicity on a mammoth scale. It's people who claim they love the working classes, and meantime they're inflating prices higher than wage rates, so the real wage rates in terms of purchasing power go down. So the unemployment problem was then solved in a very tricky and roundabout fashion. Okay, so that's the political essence of Keynesianism underneath all the camouflage. Continue on with the theory here. Well, first place, one of the things that happened was he said the Keynesians in the 1930s said, well, the economy's mired here, finished, et cetera, et cetera. You have to have mammoth government spending to what? Increase. Well, let's go this way. Continue on with this thing. Income, expenditure. There's some line here, the so-called full employment line, magic full employment line, which is somewhere. Say here. This is the line at which unemployment is wiped out if you keep increasing national income. Okay? If expenditure is such that the intersection point is below the full employment line, you have permanent depression. There's no way the free market economy can get out of it. They're stuck with the expenditure function. And there they are. They should have us $500 billion. Let's say $500 billion national income is the key to full employment. We're stuck at 300. Therefore what? Therefore the government, the god out of the machine, steps in and spends 200 extra billion to raise the expenditure function, so we just hit the full employment line, so you just fine-tune the system.
No wonder it's called gross.
Yeah. Government spends $200 billion, it's adding to total spending, so it's raised the thing to the 200 billion, to the magic full employment. Nobody knows where the full employment line is, by the way. Right? Who the hell knows where it is, but anyway. If you're in a depression, you assume it must be to the right of where we are now, so you pump in a lot of spending. If, on the other hand, the Keynesians were not very strong on inflation, they couldn't really, weren't very keen on analyzing it. They were interested in depression. But the... what am I doing? Full employment line is fixed, sorry. If the expenditure line is higher, okay, at the intersection point, and say 600 billion, that means that there's inflation. This causes inflation. If you're the right of the full employment line, you have inflation. Left of the full employment line, you have depression. It's permanent. We're stuck, we're mired in this evil expenditure function, which is no self-equilibrator as the microsphere has. Therefore, government gone out of the machine comes in, pumps in spending, or takes it out, sops up our excess purchasing power. And does what with it? Destroys it? Burns it? Who knows? So, okay, where does the government get the money from? Essentially, that's blackout also. Okay? Government spends it. It creates by deficits. It has also, in inflation, it has surpluses. Now, the original Keynesians were kind of cute about this. They said, we have a business cycle, something like this. Old fuddy-duddy reactionaries are in favor of balanced budget. Well, we are in favor of balanced budget, too, just we're not limited to the terms of the concept of the year. We believe in balancing budget over the entire cycle. Say there's 4 years of depression, we spend money, we have deficits, then there's 4 years of inflation, we have surpluses, which sop up the old deficits. So over an 8 or 10 year period, we have a balanced budget, right? This is called This is called the concept of a cyclically balanced budget. What's happened to the concept of cyclically balanced budget? It's down the old Orwell memory hole. Okay? Nobody talks about it. No Keynesian textbooks write about it. Because obviously there ain't no balanced budget. It's either a very big deficit or a slightly less big deficit. So the concept of a surplus is gone also. Nobody talks about a budget surplus anymore. You don't check inflation by budget surplus. You check it by slightly reducing the deficit. Okay. Not that. How do they get at this thing? How do they arrive at this flat function? There are two things they have to support in some way. But the expenditure function is flat, and therefore has an intersection at one point, and the stables, you can even talk about it. Well, in the first place, the first thing that happened with Keynesians came in about 1945 with Simon Kuznets, who's not one of my favorite economists, is sort of an establishment statistician. He said, well, gee, you know, if you look at it over time, over the last 150-year period, consumption doesn't go like this. National income increases, expenditure doesn't go like that. Expenditure is more or less the same proportion as national income as it always was. Therefore, expenditure function rises secularly in the long run. Keynesians say, yeah, you're right. Over a long period, expenditure keeps rising to meet income, and therefore, you don't have a sort of a 100-year depression. It's only 20 years, something like that. So the first big concession of Keynesians. Okay, yeah. Maybe we can get out of this after 20 years. Anyway, how do they get to this thing? Well, they get to this expenditure function as follows. I think in the history of economic thought, this might be the biggest single racket. Biggest single collection of fallacies.
They're tough to really judge it. That's
okay. You have this allegedly flat expenditure function. They arrive at it as follows. Well, expenditure consists of two kinds of expenditure. There's investment, and there's consumption. Investment depends on capital goods and whatever, consumption, consumer goods. Consumption is about 90% of investment, 95, 80, whatever it is. Investment, Keynes had no theory of investment. Investment is free floating, it's animal spirits, it's free will. Investment is free will, it's volatile, it's kooky, it's whatever, booms and busts. Okay? There's no determined law of investment. Consumption, however, is different. Consumption is fixed and determined, like so. Flat, intersecting at certain points.
Is that another one of their arbitrary assumptions?
Yeah, well, we're going back beyond the arbitrary assumption of expenditure function. They don't talk about expenditure function, they talk about consumption function. But this is essentially what they're saying. They're saying that an expenditure function, which can be broken down into two parts, investment, which is constant here because it's not a function, it's free will. Okay? And consumption, which is determined passive, because consumers are determined passive jerks or whatever. And they have this kind of a function. It's stable, consumption function. If supply and demand is the famous phrase for microeconomics, you know, the famous phrase for Keynes is consumption function. It sort of gets you at least a D, a test, is the word. So, consumption function is flat-ish and it's stable. Why is it flat and stable? Right? It brings it, pushes it back another. And by the way, you see, what happens then is investment is free will, consumption is passive determined. And what else is free will in the world? Government. Government expenditure is very free will. They got free will out of the yang yang. Okay? So government then steps in, you see, and supplies a deficient expenditure. Therefore, government spending is honorary investment. It's considered the same thing as investment because it's free will. Consumers are passive and determined, investors are free will, but volatile and sort of undependable. And government is free will and rational. And that steps in and corrects these flaws of the free market.
Good thing, too.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I mean, where would we be with
where that? Would we be? Right. Okay, so. How do they get this consumption function, the C plus I and all that? Well, the shape of the consumption, the key to this thing is it has to have an intersection point. If it has an intersection point, the whole thing washes out. They got it from budget studies. It's a very interesting methodological leap. 1935 or 36, the Department of Labor, I think it was, had budget studies. What they did is they investigated people's incomes and their consumption, okay? And they found out, not I think unsurprisingly, this has nothing to do with national income, these are people's income, groups of people, okay? They found out that if you go up if this is income classes, this is as you, and this is, you have this national income, well, it shouldn't be national, as the, well, let's say this is income here, this is consumption here, that if your wealthy people tended to have spent a much higher proportion, excuse me, wealthy people tended to spend a much lower proportion of income than poor people. In other words, you have something like this. This is the 45 degree line again. You have something like people who make a, let's say David Rockefeller, his income is making $50 million a year, doesn't spend it all on consumption. He spends like maybe $10 million consumption, $40 million he saves or invests, right? So you have then much lower consumption rate, consumption proportion, and a middle class is closer to the line, and something like that. And then you get the poor people, you find that lower income people spend more than they take in. So if somebody makes $2,000 a year, he spends $6,000. So you have this kind of a function. If you're dealing with income classes within the same period, same year, therefore, they said, see, that's the consumption function. Now, some of the many things wrong with this. One is, these are not dealing with national income, they're dealing with groups of people within the same national income, which is a very entirely different thing. It's true that a rich person consume less than the poor person. It doesn't mean that if everybody is richer, everybody will spend, consume less than before. Two totally different things. This whole thing gives you one point on this graph. It doesn't give you the whole graph. So that's one big problem. It doesn't establish a damn thing. Secondly, as Milton Friedman pointed out, actually Milton Friedman was probably his biggest contribution to economics, is the so-called the permanent consumption function. He said, look, people don't spend money, but they consider how much they consume out of their current income. They don't only consider their current income, they consider what their income was 2 years ago and will be 2 years from now. Suppose you have a best-selling author, for example, Irving Wallace. Let's say he writes a top novel every 5 years. If he gets $1 million 1 year, he's not going to spend all of it that year. Okay, and then have zero. He's going to allocate over a five-year period so that if you catch Irving Wallace as flush year, he'll be spending way below his, assuming way below his income. The other hand, if you catch him a year when he's making zero and spending $500,000 a year, he's here somewhere. Is a distorted picture. If you take a five-year period, you take these same income groups and take their income over a five-year period, you get a very different statistic. So Friedman potentially did that. I found out, lo and behold, that if you do that, everything changes. And so this budget study thing shifts from this to something like that. So the people who really have low incomes for 5 years spend less than their income. Where the hell do they get the money from? Of course, that's another interesting question. If you're really poor, you don't have $2 million in a little floorboards, and you don't get permanent credit either. I mean, you can get some credit from friends, neighbors, or storekeepers, but you know, pretty soon it washes out, you've got to keep getting some income. So the whole thing, when you start directing to the so-called permanent income, you get a consumption function like this, much more intelligent, and there's no intersection point. The intersection point washes out. Keynesianism is wiped out on that basis alone. Plus, you know, half of the other things we're talking about. And plus the fact it doesn't really pertain to national income changes. So that takes care of the concept of flatness. What about the stability? How do they get the stability thing? Why should it be stable? They get that from this. They take, for 30 years or so, you take national income. Okay. This is one of the great. This is sort of like a walk. Keynesianism is like, in many ways, like a walking mathematical fallacy, statistical fallacy. Take this is over different years. You take income, national income, and consumption, and plot them. Okay, and you get something like that. It's all around the same amount. In other words, the deviation, the variation around the correlation is very small. If, on the other hand, you plot national income with saving or investment, you get a much bigger variation. Yeah, something like that. Conclusion was that consumption is a very stable function of income because there's a very small variance around it, whereas investment or saving is a very volatile and free will. The what's the amount that it's really invested? Well, the investment is falling pretty low because the correlation is, the variance around it is much greater. The trick here, the gimmick involved is, if you take something and correlate it with 95% of itself, you get a very high correlation. Okay? It looks very stable. It doesn't really mean a damn thing. If, on the other hand, you correlate something with 5% of itself, you get a lot of variance. Looks like it's unstable. That is the hooker. That's the key to the Keynesian function. Okay? If you correlate something with 90% of itself, it looks stable. Correlate with 5%, 10% of itself, it looks unstable. So my little satiric thing, which I have in Manicomian State, reducing this to reductio ad absurdum, is as follows. Why only have investment plus consumption? Those aren't the only things which make up a national income. All right? Take national income, and is equal to income of Brooklyn, B, plus income of every other place except Brooklyn. Call it E for everybody. No, can't really, it's called V for everybody. Right? So, and you correlate the two things. If you correlate national income with all income except Brooklyn, this is about 99% of that. Let's say 95% of that. 99%. If you correlate national income with everything except Brooklyn, you get a very, something like that. Very high correlation, almost no variation around, almost invisible. If over 30 years, 40 years, whatever. If, on the other hand, you correlate national income with Brooklyn income, there's a lot of variation all over the place. Right? So you can therefore conclude that Brooklyn is the key. Right? Not investment. How about investment? The multiplier. The investment is equal to income equal investment plus consumption. This is 95, this is 5. The multiplier is 20. This is the famous Keynesian multiplier. The conclusion was, if you increase investment, and government spending, remember, is the same as investment, it's honorary investment, it's an increase national income by 20-fold. This was the original heady days of early Keynesianism. Okay, so, well, here we have a much more powerful multiplier. Brooklyn, we have 100-fold. You increase, you give $10 to every resident of Brooklyn, you have a $2 trillion increase in national income. Okay? This is a multiplier effect. It's a stable multiplier.
I think you should quote Murray Rothbard.
I did. That's the punchline.
Yeah.
Anticipate you're stepping on my punchline. So Brooklyn is a volatile, free will people, volatile, free willing. Everybody else is a schnook who's out there in the passive and determinate thing. And of course, as you said, the conclusion of the whole thing is the Rothbard multiplier, much more powerful. Okay? You take national income. Equals Rothbard income plus everybody else except Rothbard. You correlate them. You prove that this correlation between national income and everybody else's income is very stable. You can't see any difference. You correlate my income and national income, there's almost no correlation at all. I'm more than that. Therefore, I have free will, I'm volatile, and everything else. Everybody else is schnucky, passive, and determined. Give me $1 and I'll refashion the universe. National income will go up by $2-3 trillion.
We give you $1 million, right?
Right. Exactly. That's it. Give me money. And all good things will come under you.
You clearly solved the problem. This is what Trudeau works.
What's that?
Yeah. This is what Trudeau works.
So this is, there's nothing, and the Keynesians cannot rebut this. This is a reductive absurdum of Keynesianism. There's no way they can counter this. Except saying, well, it's ridiculous. You didn't mean that. So, anyway, I think it's pretty clear this time. This whole thing is a one big gigantic scam. The question then becomes: if the government is supposed to pump in deficits during the recession and sop up our purchasing power during the boom. First place, how do they arrange the deficits? Well, Keynesians themselves say it doesn't make any difference, just have a deficit. But it became pretty clear to people who are sort of semi-Keynesian or whatever, that it makes a certain amount of difference here. If you borrow money from, the government borrows money from capitalists, or public, it's true the government will spend, say, $100 million, but it might be offset by $100 million, not spent by these other people. They could have spent money. They could have had their own multiplier. Of course, they're supposed to be determined and passive. There's still a certain worry there that you're at least potentially reducing the public spending by government spending more. Therefore, the thing to do if you're sort of a moderate Keynesian or semi-Keynesian is to have the government specifically have deficits by printing more money, by creating more money. You'll be sure to have new spending, raising the whole expenditure function. So that's sort of a modification. Now, there's supposed to be surpluses during the boom, which never happened. That sort of washes out. Then Keynesians separated into several categories. Most people think Keynesians are all left liberals. That's not necessarily true. As a matter of fact, the people who brought us the Ford administration, the Nixon administration, and now most of the Reagan administration are Keynesians. They're conservative Keynesians. So what is this? It's a different aspect of the same doctrine. So how does this work? Well, let's say you have you're to the left of the full employment line, you're 200 and you're supposed to be 300. So the desideratum is you want a government deficit of $100 billion, right, to put you up to the line.